Books on Tape presents Queen of the Underworld by Gail Godwin, read by Carrington McDuffie. Part 1. Caminante, no hay camino, se hace camino al andar. Wayfarer, there is no road, you make the road as you go. Antonio Machado, Proverbios y Cantares, 34. Chapter 1. Now I had graduated on this bright June Saturday in 1959, and few were the obstacles left between me and my getaway train to Miami, obstacles that nevertheless must be cunningly surmounted. "Emma, you ride in front with Earl," said Mother, as expected. "I'll sit in back and reminisce a little more about my time here in Paradise." "Oh," challenged Earl. "What does that make the rest of your life, then, a come-down?"
"The rest of my life is still in progress," Mother lightly countered, making room for herself among my college leftovers that were going back to the mountains with them. "Ask me again in 30 or 40 years." We began the winding descent out of Chapel Hill, as 7 years earlier, the three of us, with my mother's new husband at the wheel, had begun another descent into a new life. Only this time, they would be dropping me off within the hour at the Seaboard Station in Raleigh. My journey as part of this family unit would soon be at an end. Happily, my train to Miami left at 1:15, so a farewell lunch had been out of the question, a circumstance diminishing that much further the chance of a last-minute blow-up with Earl. But still, I was on my guard, for already he was making those engorged throat noises that preceded a sermon. I did not dare glance back at Mother for fear of catching her eye. An exchanged look of sympathy, or, God forbid, a mutual smirk, might still explode everything sky-high as it had done plenty of times before. My job was to look respectfully attentive without rising to his bait. I folded my hands in my lap and faced front, focusing on the road ahead. Windows on both sides were open to let in the breeze, and the capricious little womp-womps of hot air provided a divertimento against Earl's opening sally and helped me keep my own counsel. Sacrifices had been made. If I would ever stop to think about other people. Empathy and gratitude, not my strong suits. Had never known what it was to apply myself on a daily basis. Hadn't been required of me. Had been raised to think that the world revolved around me and that I could coast along without making much of an effort. Not completely my fault. Had been indulged too much for my own good by teachers as well as family. But now I was going into the real world where I would have to knuckle under and deliver the goods like everybody else.
Though why you should choose to go off half-cocked to a place like Miami remains a mystery to your mother and me. Your dean told us the Charlotte Observer wanted you, but he said you'd had your heart set on Miami ever since you went down for that interview at Christmas. I said, well, we were the last to know she went to Miami for Christmas. She told us she was staying in the dorm to catch up on her work. We didn't learn the truth till February.
Damn and blast you, I thought. You have a single conversation with my dean who adores me, and you make me out a liar. I didn't want to say anything to anyone until I knew I had the job, I cautiously replied.
I told the dean she doesn't even know anybody in Miami.
I don't know anybody in Charlotte either, I refrained from saying. She knows Tess, put in Mother from the back seat. Tess was her old college roommate from Converse. Tess will be meeting her train tomorrow morning.
So why didn't she stay with Tess at Christmas when she went down for that interview?
His voice had edged up a decibel.
Well, I guess she wanted to stay with someone else at Christmas, Mother neutrally suggested.
Of course I had told them, after the fact, with whom I'd stayed,
Or rather, I had presented an acceptable configuration of the way in which this family I had worked for last summer had offered me hospitality. Not that any configuration of the Nightingales would ever be acceptable to Earl.
Well, I guess there's just no accounting for some people's taste. But to move down there to be with that tribe.
Menacing pause before the refrain.
When her dean said the Charlotte Observer would have taken her.
The voice rolled on. But so, I congratulated myself, did the car. Every mile we achieved was 1 mile nearer to my release. We had not veered off the road or had a flat tire, and nobody had backhanded me to start a black eye for my first day at work. Think of it as a scene early in a novel, I told myself. The stepfather picks one last fight with a daughter who has not appreciated him. The mother in the back seat, wedged among her daughter's boxes, knees tucked under her like a college girl, is forgiving of the wild little breezes that mess up her hairdo because they mute his voice. There will be plenty more of it to listen to on their long drive back to the mountains. Whose novel was this going to be? Not the stepfather's. The writer might never grow the empathy for that one. Not the mother's, either, though it catches in the daughter's throat to see the youthful way the older woman is clasping her knees, wrapped in her own memories of Chapel Hill, when she still expected to get everything she wanted. If it was going to be the daughter's, there would be some choked-back sobs in the mother's embrace at the train station, one last stoic offering of the daughter's mouth for the imposition of the stepfather's kiss, and then they would be gone on the next page. When, as a last-minute taunt, Earl, in the act of setting down my suitcase inside my roomette, asked if I thought I had money to burn for this exclusive little compartment with its own washroom and pull-down bed, I suppressed the perfect comeback that it was indeed a burnt offering of my graduation monies to thank the gods for my escape from him. At long last, I had learned that it was never too late for a black eye when saying goodbye to certain people. Alone in my luxury cubicle, I relaxed for the first time in months, allowing the train's diesel engine to take over the job of getting me to my destination. Woods pinked with afternoon June light alternated with tobacco fields and tin-roofed drying barns. As we shot through a dreary little hamlet, a character offered herself for my perusal. A girl, born and raised in this fly-blown place, who had dreams of going somewhere, and one day wakes up on her deathbed, a forgotten old maid who has never left town, and hears this very train hurtle by. She feels the diesel cry in the marrow of her bones, and in her last conscious moment believes she is aboard. She savors all the sweetness of having gotten out, and she expires with a rapturous smile on her face for no one to see but the undertaker. Could such a woman still exist in the late 1950s, even in rural North Carolina? Why not? Maybe I would write this existential pastoral with its O. Henry-ish ending in the evenings when I got home from my newspaper job. It was the sort of thing that might get me published in a literary quarterly, especially one of the southern ones, which abounded in stories about trains passing and nothing much ever happening at home. My plan was to become a crack journalist in the daytime, building my worldly experience and gaining fluency through the practice of writing to meet deadlines. Then, in the evening and on weekends, I would slip across the border into fiction, searching for characters interesting and strong enough to live out my keenest questions. My journalism would support me until I became a famous novelist. Perhaps I would become a famous journalist on the side, if I could manage both. I began to lower myself into the environs of the old maid's unlived life until I started feeling queasy. Despite my desperate desire to be published,
I knew this was a warning signal to get out of there. Letting yourself be trapped in the wrong...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?